Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Coming up on this week's show, Windows 3.1 saves the day during CrowdStrike.
The cutest Nintendo Wii we've ever seen.
And we chat to Mike Wilson about id Software, God Games, and Devolver Digital.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every Friday with our lovely friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one of their books you need to check out. Maybe you've got a holiday coming up, you want a bit of poolside reading. The Secret History of Mac Gaming, the new expanded edition. Celebrating the history of gaming on the Apple Macintosh with this gorgeous 480-page hardback book. With more than 250 titles, all the big ones are there. Myst, SimCity, Spectre, Shadowgate, and of course Halo, which started on the Mac. As we celebrate 40 years of the Mac, they've actually knocked £5 off the price if you get it right now. Head to bitmapbooks.com, check it out, and the rest of their retro gaming collection. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 439, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And lovely to have you joining us for our weekly geek out about all things retro gaming and technology related. Of course, every week we do the research for you. We look around, we check all the socials, check all the blogs, and bring you up to speed on what's been happening in the wonderful world of retro gaming and technology from over the last 7 days. And of course, bringing you veterans of the industry onto the show for an interview in the second half each week. And of course, this is our final show of July. Summer flying by. We have already been to some incredible events, though. There is more of them on the way. I know you were at a big gaming market over the weekend, Ravi.
Yeah, so this was a Nottingham Video Games Expo, and it's their third year. I hosted a panel with Tony Warriner as well, which was really good fun. Great to chat with Tony about, you know, Revolution Software. And the guys there were fantastic. They've been running it in Nottingham. You know, it's kind of an event that started from the ground up.
Yeah.
And it was great to see so many people there. And, you know, we had a few listeners come over and chat. I was kind of chilling out, hanging for both days. Did end up going out into town till about 2 in the morning.
Of course,
eating a kebab in the rain.
nice.
You know, yeah, that was really good. A big shout to the Journalics, who was a video game music writer,
right,
that was out there, and we went out on a town, showed him Nottingham. Yeah, it was awesome. Really good, and a great little event. I can't wait for next year's.
And then we've got another huge event coming up actually in a couple of weeks' time. You and I are going to be heading out to Norway for the annual Retro Messe event that's going to be on in Sandefjord on the 17th and 18th of August. Actually, the 10th anniversary of this year. And I've been checking their Facebook page. Already a few big guest announcements that they've made over the last couple of weeks.
Oh, yes, yes. They've got some amazing guests, as usual. You know, we're going to have Chris Hulsbeck there,
yep,
which is just amazing. Chris Marlowe, of course, you know, we have quite a few rare crew there. There's Kev Bayliss. I can never say it correctly, but Yoko Shimura as well,
yes,
of Street Fighter 2, who did the soundtrack. And hopefully me and Dan are going to interview her as well, which will be amazing because we don't get that many Japanese developers on there on the podcast. Roz Trezenga as well. Metal Jesus Rocks. You know, the list is growing. And
yeah.
This is going to be an awesome event. We always love coming out to Norway and, you know, meeting new Scandinavian folks and anyone that comes to visit.
Yeah, so if you're going to be there or take a trip out there, like we said, it's only about, what, an hour and a half? Less than a two-hour flight, isn't it, from the UK over to Norway. And so it's going to be happening in the gorgeous town of Sandefjord, where basically retro gaming takes over the entire town for the whole weekend, doesn't it? Every bar you go, yeah, in, everywhere. It's like, yeah, it's just such a good event. And great traders market there as well. If you want to pick up some, maybe some rare games that, you know, weren't all that big in this part of the world.
If you can fit them on the plane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, bring an extra case. It's going to be happening on our 17th of 18th of August in Norway. So I'll link up the website and get tickets for that. And hopefully we will see you there. Now, we're talking of amazing interviews. We have got another one on the podcast this week as well. And you guys did this one. We also love going inside the world of legendary companies like id Software.
Yeah, so this interview is just amazing. I'm so pleased and happy that Mike actually came on, and this is Mike Wilson. So, you know, Mike Wilson, you may know him from Devolver Digital, some of the latest great releases that have come out. You know, we've seen some amazing indie titles come out from them, Hotline Miami as well, Broforce, you know, some great titles there with Serious Sam Remake as well. But Mike goes back all the way to back in the days, and he actually went to school with Adrian Carmack, and you know, he ended up becoming the VP of marketing and distribution for id back in the days. And this was, you know, when they were doing Ultimate Doom, Hexen, and Quake, and even before that, he had a company that he's working with called Duango, and they did like online multiplayer, you know, back when it was dial up. And they were doing Doom servers on that. It's an amazing story because it goes through his whole time at id, goes into Ion Storm as well, which, you know, had Daikatana and the infamous John Romero's about to make you his bitch line. Yes. Then he went and he helped found Gathering of Developers, which is God Games, which was a group of lots of different kind of small developers at the time, like Epic Mega Games, Delphine, Terminal Reality, and they released a lot of titles through that, which were like stuff, you know, mainly on the PC. Jazz Jack Rabbit 2, absolutely wicked game. Whole Railway Tycoon as well. Tropico, one of my favorite ones. Max Payne. There was just so many titles that came out with them. And then Doug Myers, who worked with, founded it, sadly passed away. And, you know, they reformed, but they still kept the same philosophies and ideas as they went into these new game companies like GameCop Media as well, and then Devolver Digital. And this is where the indie scene started to really blow up again. And, you know, you were getting lots of interest in the indie games world. And Mike's a really interesting guy because he's always had that philosophy of kind of just do it because you love it. Don't go for the mainstream. Go for something that you think's cool. Something that you think is going to kind of stand out. And it seems to have kind of worked, you know. It's got to the stage that it is. And he started with one of the coolest kind of products out there, which was Doom at the time.
Yeah, I mean, even going back into that kind of legacy of the indie scene, like going back to the shareware days. I mean, you know, it's been around for a long time.
Yeah, he was the guy that basically put shareware into retail venues, you know, the full version. So that's quite a big achievement by then. What did you think of the interview, Joe? Because I know you joined me on this one.
I thought it was absolutely fantastic. You know, you've just said a lot about all the games we kind of talked about, but I think it was a really nice kind of different point of view, because obviously Mike is a businessman, but he takes such a different approach, and it was just a real nice breath of fresh air. And without going into it too much, kind of like what he's doing these days, and kind of how he ends the interview and stuff. It was really beautiful, and it was just a really, really good discussion.
It was kind of like that idea of going from bedroom to billions, or kind of, you know, that home coder suddenly getting their game out there and people actually loving it and giving them the opportunity to do that through publishing them, where other big publishers might not choose that title or might bring in a team of, you know, hundreds of people.
I always find that interesting, like the journey from, you know, how games got from inception to programming, like into the stores, particularly back in the pre-internet days as well, like you said, getting, you know, shareware into shops, which I definitely do remember seeing, like, you know, in the early 90s. So looking forward to this one. Mike Wilson, formerly of id Software, and lots more as well. He's going to be our special guest on the show in around 35 minutes from now. Now, of course, before that, we have a little roundtable about what's been happening in the world of retro gaming from over the last 7 days. And this is quite an interesting story. And I must admit, at the moment, I'm really keen to get some kind of broadband modem for my Sega Saturn. I've been thinking about that quite a bit, because I did a video on my YouTube channel a while ago, like surfing the web with a Dreamcast. It was surprisingly quite popular, so I thought it might be quite cool to do something similar with Saturn, because I've never experienced playing the Saturn online before. Have you ever played a Saturn online before, Joe?
No, I don't think... you know what? I'm a big Saturn fan, as you know, but I don't even know if you could get it online in the UK, to be perfectly honest. Back in the day, like officially, I'm sure there's many unofficial ways, you know, etc., especially nowadays as well, with all different products and stuff that are out. But it is mad to think, because obviously for me, like online gaming, it was the Xbox 360, that's where it blew up. But it is crazy to think that, you know, across the pond in Japan, you know, you mentioned the Sega Saturn, they have the Mega Drive online as well.
Yes, they did, you're right, yeah. I completely forgot about
And kind of like when I see these things, I'm like, oh, it was, they'd get lottery results, or they'd get the weather on it, or, you know, they'd do these different things on it. But then what we're about to talk about is actually like, I'm like, oh, okay, they didn't just like do these things on it. They were playing, not only were they playing the Sega Saturn online against other players, they were playing it cross-platform with PC as well.
Because we told this story a few weeks ago about a Dreamcast game that was cross-play, didn't we? And we thought that was groundbreaking.
And, but the fact we've been mentioning like the Saturn and playing online quite a bit recently, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. Yeah, we mentioned the Dreamcast and the PS2 had cross-play with Capcom versus SNK2 back in 2001. But this is a game called Dragon's Dream, which this isn't the reason we're talking about it, but it's just it came up as part of it. But this was a Sega Saturn game that came out in 1997, which was giving out free when, I say free, it was part of a bundle. So if you bought the Sega Saturn modem or the Sega Saturn keyboard, you got this game with it to play online from between December 97 and March 1998. And then later in April 1998, it was released on Windows 95 as well. And it was cross-platform, which is really interesting anyway.
Yeah.
But the reason we're talking about this is the servers of the game were turned off in October 1999. And it has made the game completely unplayable, because when you try to start the game, like so many modern games now, it will look for the servers. And if it can't find the servers, the game will not boot up. The game hasn't been able to boot up since 1999. And we'll get to that in a minute. But what I found really interesting was the cost to play this bad boy online.
Like you said, this is pre-broadband. This was like, it was literally your pay per minute in most places in the world for dial-up internet back then.
Yeah, we actually talk about that in Mike's interview as well.
Yeah, we do, actually. Yeah, we do. So you needed a Fujitsu Nifty server plus a 500 yen a month subscription, which is only a couple of pounds, really, and then a 10 yen per minute game fee, which I've looked up at the moment is only half a penny.
Right. All adds up though if you're playing those late night gaming sessions.
Yeah. And then as well as that, your telephone bill. So it did charge you standard telephone call as well to play this online.
It was like a premium rate service, wasn't it? Yeah, Nifty Serve. It was like, you know, like your Sega Net.
And I've looked it up and, you know, it's quite a cool looking basic RPG, very Sega Saturn in terms of its graphics, like 2D sprites with 3D backgrounds and stuff. But the reason we're talking about this, as interesting as this all is, ex-user called Memory Fallen has not managed to get this game back online. But what they've done is they've managed to get themselves into the debug menu through hacking the game, essentially, and then releasing the hack through a special save file that you can download, which essentially gets you into the debug menu that then can get you into the game, into the battles, so you can get yourself into the battle screens and play pre kind of like made battles, which I imagine from it being in the debug menu was for the developers to try when they were developing the game to make sure the battle system works.
I think it might just be bypassing the like online check and then going straight into it, and you know, you're doing a battle, you're in that thing, but I don't know if you can set up AI opponents or you know, if it's just you alone.
It looks like there is opponents in there, like, you know, just the computer is in there. By the looks of things on the video, you're fighting a three-headed dragon wyvern kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe the way the game worked was like it looks quite squad based, four of you, and you're the only person playing that. So like
Hired Guns, it reminds me of a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Or like, you know, when you're in World of Warcraft and you've got a clan, it's basically just you fighting these kind of pre.
Rather than, I think you could be right there. It could have been the four of you would play online and you would all control your own character And obviously it's a turn-based RPG, but in this debug menu, I think you just control all four yourself.
Yeah, and
fight the dragon.
It looks like it's an early patch, but it's quite cool, actually. I love how, you know, save files and stuff can be used to exploit games and make them do different things without having to, you know, deconstruct the whole game, really.
I think what you said, though, Joe, the fact that it's going into the debug mode from reading the... There's like a Substack with basically the story of how he's done this and what modifications he's made to it. And he said, even though you can fight the dragon will fight you back, but the dragon can't actually damage you.
Right.
So it looks like it's in some kind of, like you said, probably a mode for developers to be able to test out the mechanics of it without, like a cheat mode, essentially, where they're not going to die in the game. But yeah, I mean, really the exciting thing is no one's been able to play this game, see how the mechanics work and explore the levels for 25 years. So the fact that, you know, he's been able to bypass those long gone server checks and get into the game and look around it, I think is definitely a big step. And we know the way these things often work, you know, particularly as we've seen on the Dreamcast scene recently. And like you said, Ravi, it does seem like the Sega Saturn scene is becoming much more active in recent months. So it would be cool. Now it's out there. I mean, he's released this. You can download this patch. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if people do get this up and running again and make their own kind of third-party servers so people can play it again online in the modern age. That would make sense, I think. I mean, you know, he's already kind of done the hard part by bypassing the checks, I guess. It's just a case of rerouting it, I'd imagine.
I think that sounds like a job for you.
Yeah, I'll do it this weekend. Nothing on this weekend. I'll be playable by Monday. So if you want to check that out, and you have got better skills than me, no chance I'll be able to do that. I will link that up in this week's show notes as well. Now, last Friday, we won't give away too much about your career, Joe, but you do work in the IT industry and support. You had a bit of a nightmare, didn't you, on Friday morning? I remember you were almost tearing your hair out in our little messenger group.
Yeah, good old CrowdStrike, my best friend for the last week or so of work. I won't go into detail too much, but yeah, pretty much completely destroyed my, well, my last 3-4 days at work.
And not just you, the entire IT industry, it seems. You know, we all these pictures of airlines and, you know, flights getting cancelled.
Did you see the pictures in India where they were handwriting boarding passes?
God, no, I didn't see those.
Handwritten boarding passes to get on planes. I was like...
But I saw pictures of, you know, there was a, I think, screens in Times Square showing blue screens of death. I saw pictures of those, you know, like I said, at airports, train stations, Joe's office. this massive crash.
Of my work as well, but it wasn't on the grander scale,
Yeah, I mean, originally a lot of people were blaming Microsoft, but obviously as we found out later, it was this corporate antivirus service, CrowdStrike, which from what I've been reading, even if, you know, companies were running on Linux, if, you know, this could have affected Linux in the same way, for example. So it wasn't really a Windows failure as such. However, a lot of companies obviously weren't able to do business on Friday while we had this one of the biggest, if not the biggest, global IT outage. But it turns out that one airline, which is Southwest Airlines, who are the fourth largest airline in the US, were continuing completely unaffected while other airlines were, you know, cancelling flights. They went on because it turns out they were using Windows 3.1 from 1992, which wasn't affected by CrowdStrike, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, it's probably solid, you know, that definitely wouldn't have been getting updates, but I think that's really cool. And they could have played Sim Tara as well whilst they were waiting.
While they're waiting in the airport lounge, you let everyone on it. But I mean, some people have been talking about the fact that they're kind of outraged that the fourth largest airline in the US is still using an operating system from over 30 years ago.
I saw loads of silly tweets everywhere and stuff, and people going, this wouldn't have happened with a ZX Spectrum. This wouldn't have, you know, and it was like kind of a weird, glorious day of the retro people going, we got our revenge. You know, I find it interesting. It just does show how reliant we are on kind of technology. And especially with the blue screen of death coming up, because that's retro in itself, isn't it?
Unless you're like me, on these days.
Yeah, unless you're like me, who built his own PC, blue screens of death all the time.
Well, talking about this this system that Southwest Airlines are using, you might be relieved to know they're not using Windows 3.1 to fly the planes, but it's their scheduling software. So I think that was kind of a big downfall, like you said, you know, the fact that a lot of planes were doing handwritten boarding passes, and the scheduling was a big reason why they couldn't have flights taking off. But yeah, Southwest Airlines are still using a Windows 3.1 based system for scheduling their flights. And apparently they use one based on Windows 95 for their staff scheduling system as well. So it meant that, you know, luckily, because they were running Windows 95 for that, the staff all knew when they could come in. You know, there wasn't any problems with people missing work or anything.
Don't be late for work.
Yeah, we're running this on Windows 95.
But I mean, bosses like, get those Windows 3.1 machines up, go.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I imagine, I don't know too many details about the back end of this. It's probably not a 386 running in a server room. No, I wouldn't have thought. No. I imagine this is a virtualized in some way, but you know, it's that old adage, isn't it? Of if, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it. Which in this case, I mean, we've talked before about, particularly, you know, industries like the airline industry, there's, you know, still planes that do manual updates of floppy disks. There are a lot of planes that still have floppy disk drives in them where they do software updates that way because, you know, these are very expensive machines and it's not really feasible to replace them every time a new version of an operating system comes out. And also, you know, you'll know yourself, Joe, working in the IT industry, doing upgrades and updating operating systems and rolling out new software. It's a very expensive job when you get to services of this scale.
It slows everything down as well, doesn't it? Like, yeah, you know, so sometimes a closed system's quite good and you don't need like a huge hyper-threaded machine with all these, you know, extra power to do like scheduling, you know, yeah, maybe like a lot of data analytics or something like that. But, you know, I do kind of like old school stuff. You know, train timetables, they used to be done. I was amazed when I actually went to India and they were still doing train timetables by hand. So they're kind of used to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen banking software that still runs on OS 2.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a big job changing all this and so expensive. So it doesn't surprise me that they're still running code, you know, I imagine, like I said, virtualized. But I mean, you know, running it on Windows 3.1, and that Windows 95 saved the day for them. So I imagine that on Friday, Southwest Airlines were probably a lot more profitable than their competitors who couldn't take off. So there's a lesson to be learned there somewhere. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but it is nice to see that Windows 3.1 made the headlines in a positive way last week. So if you want to read that story, I'll link it up in this week's show notes. Now, I did love seeing this one as well. This is very cute. I'm looking over at my keys now. Do you look at your key ring and think, you know, I've got like an Apple AirTag on there. I've got a bottle opener, which, you know, is obviously essential if you end up at a house party or something. One thing I've never thought of adding to my rather bulky collection of keys next to my car key and my house key is a Nintendo Wii. But I do want one after seeing this.
I decluttered my key rings a couple of years ago, you know, because
they're brave.
Silly. And literally I have like front door key and car key.
I've got keys on mine. I don't know what they do. I've got a feeling that one of them might be my bike unlock key from my bike I had at uni 20 years ago.
Nice. I like that.
In case it's not, I don't get rid of it.
And his bike's still at uni, locked up.
Yeah, I'd be like an ancient symbol all the students pray to now, the abandoned holy ancient bike.
The brand new bike because Dan never used it. But yeah, I might be tempted to come back and clutter the keyring with a keyring Wii, fully playable, 6cm by 6cm, 1A.
My micro console. We've had the mini consoles. Now these are the micro consoles.
Well, this is the Kawaii, which is quite a clever play on words. Because Kawaii in Japanese, that means cute, yeah? Kawaii?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so it is very cute. The spelling it K-A-W-A-I-I, obviously the double I like the Wii, which is, it's actually, we've talked about this before, when they basically trim the motherboards right down. Mm-hmm. And because the first time I saw this, I thought, well, this is probably like a little emulator box or something like that. That's not that impressive. But actually, this is a proper Nintendo Wii in there using the Omega trim method, which we talked about this before. Okay. It's kind of when they cut it all down and it's very involved. I mean, you've got to be very good at electronics to do this. A lot of resoldering and reseating components to make it work.
And no fans in there as well. So it's got passive cooling on the metal, which is...
Yeah, it's a heatsink.
Yeah, pretty mental.
Yeah, so this is a real Wii. They've shrunk it down into a very small form factor. And it looks very good. I mean, they've got this in a machined metal unibody case at the moment that looks really nice. And if you go onto their... there's actually a BitBuild forum thread detailing kind of all the different variants that they've done. A lot of different cases in there as well, different colours too. And that kind of shows you the build process. And there is quite an impressive picture of... this console sitting next to some other ones, including a Sega Dreamcast, and it looks tiny compared to the Dreamcast. So basically saying the height of this is like having two Game Boy carts stacked on top of each other.
Yeah, it's teeny weeny, to say the least. It kind of reminds me of like a Zippo lighter. I think it's probably a little bit bigger than that. But what I do love is obviously the Wii, famously backwards compatible with the GameCube.
Mm.
It has a GameCube docking station as well.
Yes.
If you will, you can dock it into a little metal, probably slightly wider than it, but still very, very small, probably about 7 centimeters by about a centimeter tall. You can dock into the GameCube controller four ports. So yeah, you can also play the GameCube on it with the controllers as well.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. But for me, it's like it's a Wii. Where's the port for the sensor bar? And, you know, if you're going to play a Wii, then...
That's a good question.
You know, play it in the way.
I've got a feeling that you might actually need the dock. Because looking at the dock, you've got the... it's where the power goes into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's also like a...
There's a little eye symbol next to it, but I don't know. That's probably going to be video output for me because there's eye and then there's like a music one, but none of them look in that kind of square that you get with the sensor bar. That would scream Wii to me. Obviously, you can use it as a good GameCube emulator. Like the Wii's wicked for emulation, so you could have loads of emulators and all of that. But that's the primary function for me is I want to play Wii Sports on it.
On the go.
Yeah, yeah. A bit of bowling. Hook it up to something like a little screen or something. So yeah, maybe they have alternative docks coming out, but that was a glaring kind of like, but where's the sensor bar go?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the Wii obviously is not a portable console. When you've got this thing kind of hooked up, there is going to be wires kind of traipsing off everywhere. But, I mean, I do think it's very cool. I like the method of having a, because you're going to have to carry the dock around as well.
Maybe it comes with two candles, you know. You can do a fake sensor bar with two candles. So it might just come with two little tiny candles and that's it.
And again, I mean, you are going to have modded firmware on here because there's no optical drive on it, obviously. You're not going to fit discs into it, so I imagine you have to play the games off an SD card, you know, like a modded Wii. But I think, you know, I love these homebrew projects. I think, you know, the amount of, not only the kind of creativity that goes into this as well, but I just love the way it looks. I love the design of it. It actually reminds me a bit, I've got a Sony mini disc player from the early 2000s, it's kind of in this same kind of blue color that they've got in these renders as well. This kind of, you know, like a metal kind of blue case. And they've got the,
get me started on mini discs.
Yeah, that'll be a whole rabbit hole we'll go down there with rabbit.
2 hours of mini disc chat.
Yeah, but I think it's obviously even smaller than that as well. A little bit nervous, they've got the Nintendo logo on the back of it. I imagine that's probably something that when they release these, because you can actually pre-order one right now. They're selling these for, I think it's $55 per unit.
That's a good price, to be fair, yeah.
Including the shell in your selected colour, the screws and shipping as well.
Do you have to cut it down yourself, or do they?
Yeah, well, I mean, at the moment it's saying, yeah, it's basically you express your interest. So they basically need 30 people to order them, and then they said the price will go down per unit. I'd imagine, I mean, it says that will include the shell in your selected colour, so it doesn't really give you detail on whether the Wii is included. Because like you said, it is quite a in-depth job for somebody who's not all that hot electronics. So it'd be cool if they did include it, though. I've clicked on the form. There's a Kawaii Express Your Interest form, which at the moment is closed. It says, thank you for your interest. We've obtained all the data we need for now. So I imagine maybe they got a little bit inundated.
Nintendo, we're interested in this logo.
Yeah, well, yeah. There's that story the other week, wasn't there, about someone grassing up a homebrew to someone from Nintendo on LinkedIn. And the Nintendo CEO actually saying, oh, thank you for pointing that out. So hopefully this will stay off his radar. But yeah, looks very cool. If you want to check that out, looks absolutely gorgeous and ingenious, I think. So the Kawaii, that is available to pre-order, hopefully again soon. Like I said, it has closed right now, but I'll link that up in the show notes as well. Now, while we're talking about Nintendo, what about this? Did you ever expect to see Halo running on the Game Boy? Well, if you dreamt about this, it is now a reality.
A version of Halo that Joe might like.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're talking about, you're not a fan of Halo, are you, Joe?
No, not a big fan of Halo. You guys maybe play it on the After Hours. Still not a big fan of Halo, unfortunately. I never got the hype. I'm not saying it's a bad game or anything like that. I just time splitters through and through. This does look cute. They did do Halo Combat Evolved for the Atari 2600, God, about 8 years ago, seven, 8 years ago.
Yeah,
we were talking about it. But this is for the Game Boy Color, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was a lot more basic, obviously. And
way basic.
This is very like RPG-like. You got a series of different levels, and you've also got different weapons as well, which is pretty cool. What do you think of the look of it? Obviously, straight away, it reminded me of like Zelda or something.
Yeah, I thought Ravi will hate the look of this because, again, it's in that kind of chibi, kind of cutesy style.
I guess like Master Chief's helmet's so big.
Yeah.
He is all helmet, isn't he?
It's going to be hard to do in small pixels, so at least he's identifiable and different from the other characters. I don't mind the graphics. I think it's Game Boy. You know, it reminds me of Pokemon a bit.
I literally took the words right out of my mouth there. I think Link's Awakening for the Game Boy cross Pokemon is definitely the kind of the look they've gone for. I do like the perspective of the game. Like, they've kind of, you know, there's some perspectives of the game where they've made it look a bit more 3D, a bit more wide. I think they've captured the essence of Halo really well. But gameplay-wise, is it an RPG or is it a shooter?
I think it's a shooter, but it's captured elements of the game where there's a lot more, like, lore in there. And, you know, the Halo world is a lot more kind of explored, where you're not just chucked on a ship and there's nice music. And talking into music, it's absolutely banging.
There you go.
There it is.
Yeah, I really like that. Obviously, you can't hear the monks in it, but you can imagine they're there. The look of it, though, I mean, yeah, because I mean, they've changed it. It's obviously not an FPS game. They've changed it into like an overhead. Like you said, a bit like an RPG kind of style game. And I think, yeah, I mean, they've made this in GB Studio, which is a software development kit for the Game Boy, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of games have been coming out on the Game Boy and the Game Boy Color recently. And I feel like, obviously, this wasn't the catalyst, but, you know, the grimmest Game Boy Color game that McDonald's did.
Yeah. Yes.
I feel like since we covered that, like every other week, this game's being made in that GB Maker in the GB Studio.
Yeah, and this is playable on original hardware. So when we first saw it, we're like, oh, is this just like a game that looks like a Game Boy game? But you can actually download the ROM file and play it on an emulator, or if you've got like a flash cart for your Game Boy Color, you can play it on there as well. But also there is a web interface. I've got like an emulator, so you can play it on their itch.io page. Must admit, I'm looking through all the comments on it, and everyone had the same problem that you and I had, Joe, which is, how the hell do you start the game?
Yeah. It wasn't until Ravi told me that you have to press Alt.
Yes.
You see, I'm used to playing, like, the first Pokemon I played on an Amiga 4000 all the way through with a keyboard, you know, a big CRT. Like, that's how I used to play Game Boy games. Because I know it's not one.
It's not mentioned in the controls yet. It says, shift to select and start is enter, which I was hitting that for ages, couldn't get into
just
it.
Just bash every button and something else. Yeah. Start so it.
If you are playing it and you're struggling to get into it, yeah, just press the left Alt key or the Option key if you're on a Mac, and that will get you into it and you can play it online. So it is free to play. It's only the first level at the moment, but he said he is going to do more of the game, and hopefully Microsoft will leave him well alone and just let him continue this kind of under the radar, because it does look very cool. So if you want to check that out, that is available to play now. I love the fact that the game download, the entire thing, is only 2 megabytes as well. You forget kind of how small games were back in the day. So it's very cool. Well, we're talking about tiny, cute things as well. I'm looking at my Apple Watch now. You ever wish that your watch was an iPod?
I don't wear watches.
I had an Apple Watch, but I sold it for a Fitbit because I hated it so much. But this case does make it a bit more appealing.
Well, this is, I mean, yeah, I basically use, I think I've talked about this before, that, you know, I do wear my Apple Watch mainly. I mean, you're right, Ravi, I really just use it as a step counter, really, and to kind of, you know, if I get a text through it, yeah, it's quite
I just thought more notifications. It's another place to annoy me.
rather than getting like adverts popping up, you know, from my local pizza place on my phone, they also pop up on my wrist now, like you said, just to doubly annoy me. When I first got my Apple Watch, it was doing that thing that you can turn off in the settings every half an hour, reminding him that you need to stand up and walk around.
Dan was standing up in his office.
Like, that got old very fast. But this is a case that you can basically, you take the straps off your Apple Watch and you can put it in a case that the same transforms it into an iPod-like minimalist phone.
Yeah.
So what this does, I mean, it basically, you've got the digital crown on the side.
Which is like the wheel, basically.
Yeah, so, I mean, that does a lot of the controls. I mean, you can kind of scroll through your apps and, you know, read things on there by using the digital crown. This really looks like it's basically just replicating the functionality of the digital crown, but you put your watch without a strap inside this little plastic case, and it's got a scroll wheel like an iPod that you can then use to control your watch.
Yeah, and then obviously you've got like still features on there like the music and all of those kind of apps, but it will probably still be connected to your phone. I guess you can take it off and run around and have it as a separate thing, because you can do calls on them, can't you, now?
There's a cellular one, so you can you don't actually need an iPhone with it. You can just have a watch, you know, connected to the cell network itself. So for that, I mean, that would be, you know, it can basically make this into a complete standalone unit then.
Well, the thing that appeals to me, so I went down this mad rabbit hole of iPods recently, and one of my favourite one was the iPod Nano, which was quite a thin one. Now, the iPod Nano has this problem where the battery expands, pushes on the screen, and there's a black
spicy pillows, I think they're called, aren't
they? Spicy pillows, is that what it's called? And you can't get it out of the case because you have to slide it all out of the metal casing. That's my favourite model, and this kind of resembles that. I've also been looking at the iPod modding scene, and there's a program called Rockbox.
Yes.
Which you can, you know, you can put flash drives into iPods now. You can have, you know, lossless audio in there, and you can run it with Rockbox, which is really cool. So, I totally went down this kind of like iPod nostalgia. So I think there is a market for it, definitely, and I think more people are looking at stuff like that. You know, with me, it would just be disconnect all the notifications and have it as a solo music player. Maybe there's a way of doing that. But if you do have one lying around, it's a different way to use it, isn't it?
Yeah, because I mean, I've got, I do have two older Apple Watches lying around. I'm just kind of in a drawer, you know, like when I've upgraded. I just kind of kept the old ones because, you know, they're not really worth trading in. And, you know, when you use an older model, it's so slow. But I think, you know, something like this, you know, repurposing it as a music player, because you can store your music collection on a watch. And there's a few different sizes as well. Cause, I mean, obviously the Apple Watch comes in various different sizes. So there's one called the Tiny Pod, which is the case with the scroll wheel that goes for $79.99.
That's dollars, so they're not, that's not bad.
Yeah, dollars, yeah, they're not cheap. I mean, there's a smaller one that's basically a case without the scroll wheel, which kind of completely defeats the object of this, I think, which is only $29.99.
Well, yeah, I say it's not bad because it's an Apple product. Do you know how much they usually are as well?
But I've still got a big collection of iPods, and I do still use my iPods quite a bit. You know, particularly, I think I've, you know, talked about it on the podcast before, whenever I go on holiday, because you can never guarantee what like a hotel's Wi-Fi is going to be like.
You know, I just like using it uninterrupted. I looked at a little Sony MP3 player as well recently that they're doing in this kind of style as well. And that's like lossless and flack and all of that. And I was thinking,
they're quite cheap, aren't they?
You know, if you're on a plane. Yeah, that was about 60, 70 quid. Yeah. And a really good quality one, the Sony one. So, you know, companies are starting to take this approach again.
About the same price as this case. So you could just get the road, admittedly. But yeah, I mean, I do like the experience of using an iPod, I think, is still nice. It's funny because, you know, there are some people who, you know, will kind of take the mick out of you for using an iPod still. But then I've got friends that literally pay like Spotify subscriptions. They listen to the same five albums over and over again.
Yeah.
They're paying for it every month.
I don't like to be a slave to the algorithm with my music. You know, it's it's stuff that you've lovingly collected over the years, and it's nice to have it in a place, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I do still enjoy using my iPod as well. But I mean, this is a bit of a gimmick, really, isn't it, I think?
Yeah.
Probably a bit too expensive for what it is. But like I said, it is an Apple product. But if you want to check that out, those who are on sale now, that is called the Tiny Pod. Now, it is the last weekend of the month. That does mean on Sunday evening, it is going to be something that we look forward to every single month. It is our massive patrons hangout. And these are so much fun. For people who haven't joined the hangout before, Joe, I mean, give us the sizzle on it. What's a hangout about?
It's a huge online call with the three of us and anybody who wants to join, any patrons who want to join. And we just chat. Usually starts off tech and geeky stuff, but it can go anywhere, you know, trying to identify what's this circuit board, talking about old VHS, all the way down to talking about sometimes, and this is going to really not sell it, but it just goes to show how friendly we've all become with each other. Talking about like how to get rid of damp in your roof and
yes.
stuff like that is literally a
bunch of... I thought you were going to say how to get rid of Dan.
How to get rid of Dan.
We talked about missed that one. Yeah, I was still left a call by that.
But yeah, no, we have a round table chat. It's like a night at the pub, isn't it?
Yeah.
We do it for a couple of hours. Yeah, I think sometimes we can go on all night if we could. But yeah, it's really fun. And we've been doing it over 4 years now. Four and a half years we've been doing it for. And we always say it, people can come on and they can just watch. They can come on and not go on camera or anything like that and just listen if they want to. Sometimes people come on and, you know, have a right good natter in a chat as well. It's just really, really fun. I always like to sit down and, you know, have a fizzy drink or a cider or something while I do it. And just, you know, listen along and listen to everybody's stories and stuff and just talk to my mates. It's wicked.
I love seeing all the pickups people have got as well over the last month. That's really interesting. Because, I mean, pretty much everyone on the Hangout's got way better collections than we have.
Well, there's always a suggestion of a game or a title that you've not tried. And you come out with a list of stuff that you're like, oh, I need to check that out. I need to check this out, you know.
Yeah, so if you'd like to join us for that, we'd love to see you there. We're always very welcoming to new members as well. We get them all the time. And like we said, there's people all around the world joining us on the Hangouts as well. So we're going to be doing that this coming Sunday evening, the 28th of July from 8 p.m. till 10 p.m. UK time. If you join us on Patreon right now, you will get an invite to that. And also going to be recording in the next week our latest episode of our patrons-only podcast that we do for our gold members and above, which is called the Retro Hour After Hours, I believe episode number 43.
That's a lot. You know, if you sign up, you can get that whole back catalogue of 43 episodes. And they're probably like 2 hours each.
So, a lot of them are,
That's a lot of listening there.
Yeah, so you unlock that as well. You get the normal podcast ad-free every week, drop all the ads out. You get about 10, 15 minutes of extra news stories every single week. Going to be talking about some Nokia stuff in a moment and a great Mario ROM hack just for our patrons. So a really good time to join us on there. And of course, the main reason that you're doing it is just to support this podcast and make sure that we can keep bringing it out every single week. If you like what we do, think of it as a little tip, Joe. We'd really appreciate it. All the details to join our wonderful patrons community are on the website right now at theretrohour.com. Right then, next, going to be joined by this week's special guest, going inside the world of id Software, the indie scene, early shareware games as well, with our guest Mike Wilson, next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with Mike Wilson, and he's the business guy at id Software. You know, he helped launch the retail shareware version of Quake. Also worked at Ion Storm, Gathering of Developers, Devolver Digital, and really helped spark that indie game revolution that's been going on recently. And, you know, we love to ask our guests a very, like, personal question, and that was, what was your first gaming experience that you remember or a game that really kind of stood out to you when you were a little kid?
Well, it's funny. I was thinking about this recently, thinking about Intellivision games. A friend of mine posted a Night Stalker game, and I was like, it took me back to that time. And I never had an Atari, but I had a Magnavox Odyssey 2, I think was my first gaming system. And playing a game called Casey Munchkin was a ripoff of Pac-Man, Burger Time, you know, things like that. But what I remembered from that era was the sports games, the football and tennis on television, which were, once I really got into the culture of gaming, very few people talk about those sports games. But for me, they were a huge part of my childhood, and I've gotten back into them now. I'm playing Madden and Top Spin for the first time in, I don't know, 40 years or something like that. Yeah.
Did you go to any arcades as well when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah, loads. Yeah, my mom, my dad passed early, but I remember my mom taking me to this pizza shop in the mall that had Space Invaders, and I think they got Tron eventually. And yeah, it was always a treat. And there was a convenience store down the street as well that had a couple of two or three machines rotating in or out at any time, you know, Defender and Donkey Kong and such. So I guess gaming has, as a young man, always seemed like a more of a rare treat than something that was a regular part of my life, really. I grew up at a time where I spent a lot of time outdoors, mm-hmm. thankfully.
Not like kids these days, then.
No, I don't know. There, some of these kids, this next generation, I've got a 16-year-old son, and they seem to have an innate sense of balance around these yeah. things. So he has an easier time going 2 weeks without his any electronics than his old man does.
So obviously you're a marketing guy, you know, getting ahead of myself a little bit there. But do you remember when you were younger, any sort of big marketing campaigns that stood out to you growing up for like gaming? Do you remember seeing kind of like a turn in the culture of it at all?
I don't know if a lot of kids grow up thinking I want to be a marketer or a business person, you know, and I certainly didn't either. I mainly, my first experience with the real power of marketing, I think, was just my incessant relationship with MTV as an adolescent when it was new. And that was just like brand. And I was like, oh, that really works. MTV seems like the coolest thing in the world. But I don't know if I was paying attention to any games marketing at the time. And again, it's just not really an aspiration a lot of people have to be a business or marketing person, I don't think. Although, you know, Bewitched was on television and there was an advertising guy with a really hot witch for a wife. So, you know, it didn't seem all bad.
Well, I was wondering what kind of education you had as well and what led you to get involved with Duwango.
It was my education that led me to get involved in a roundabout way, but it was in high school and college in Shreveport, Louisiana, I was lucky enough to go to school with Adrian Carmack. Wow. And Adrian was just a pen and paper artist that was like the guy everybody would go to if they needed something drawn for a t-shirt or for a button or whatever in high school. And he was kind of he looked like a stoner dude, like a stoner rock and roll dude, but he wasn't at all. Like he was a in disguise art nerd, you know? And I noticed that I had the ability to speak and relate to people like Adrian or the football team or the, you know, whomever. I had this quality about me, whereas the football players would ask me to go talk to my weird artist friend.
you'd be like the middleman
on their behalf, which really, if you look at it, is kind of what my career ended up being, is translating between engineers and artists and business people and, you know, marketing and finance and all of that, and somehow getting them to work together without wanting to murder one another. So I learned that in high school, I think. It may have been my only innate talent. And then Adrian, I remember in college, he got a job as a $5 an hour intern with these guys who had assembled in Shreveport, Louisiana to make a game of the month for a thing called Soft Disk, which was a very early magazine shipping with a floppy disk every month. And John Carmack and John Romero and Jay Wilbur and who else was it? Tom Hall. They were all assembled in this lake house in Shreveport, Louisiana, of all places. None of them were from there, but that's where this disc magazine was. And they had them making a game a month. And Adrian begrudgingly learned one computer program. I think it was MS Paint so that he could help them make their pixel art games. And a couple of years later, I got a call and he's like, oh my God, these guys just hired me. Like I have a salary. I'm like, those nerds you were making games with? He's like, yeah. And he's like, I'm making $23,000 a year. I'm like, wow. And then like 2 months later, he's calling me with, he'd just gotten a $50,000 bonus. Wow. And then another few months, he had bought a mansion and a Ferrari. I'm like, what those game guys? So, and I had sort of followed along. Like, I would visit them every now and then while they were, I met them playing Dungeons and Dragons in their underwear in that lake house in Shreveport. That was my entry into the group and the reason they trusted me when they were starting to find real success. And I was one of very few friends they had that they trusted that did businessy type stuff. So that's sort of how I fell into it. And when Duango came about, it was this thing that these two guys in Houston had figured out a way to make people be able to play Doom against each other over the phone line rather than to carry a computer over to your friend's house, which was the solution before that. And they were super excited about it at id, but they also didn't fully trust these guys. And they sent me to sort of investigate and sort of be their man on the inside. And that's how I got hired at Duango and ended up running around installing modem racks in every area code in the United States as fast as we could so that people could make a local phone call to play Doom against each other. Because at the time, making a long distance phone call and playing Doom for hours would result in a $1,000 phone bill.
Wow. Those $50,000 bonuses sure go quick.
Yeah, no, but our new customers, these new people that were experiencing death matching from home against their friends for the first time, they were racking up quite a phone bill, often on their parents' line.
I was wondering, was it hard to go from just the kind of Doom fans to the public and kind of sell them the idea of this, you know, online multiplayer?
I mean, at the time, this was still the core of the core. Mm-hmm. Like, very few people knew that this was possible. You know, to have a 14.4 modem was still a sort of a luxury item and a computer fast enough to run Doom. You had to be a bit of an enthusiast back then. So it definitely was not a mainstream situation. And I have luckily gotten the gift of never having to worry much about the mainstream in my whole career, which, if you've ever worked in marketing, is a real relief to not have to like shave off all the weird edges and make something that everyone might like. As marketing stuff goes, that's about as good as it gets.
So we're speaking of the insane people and the players. What kind of games? What games came along next then? So Doom's obviously, it's blowing up. You've got this niche amount of players who are now playing it online. What was the next step there? What was the kind of conversations, what were happening? What games were chosen?
These guys, they were called GT Interactive, Good Times Interactive at the time out of New York. They were brand new. And they had approached id and said, hey, can we put Doom 2 in all the stores all over the country instead of people just mailing you a check and you mailing them a floppy disk? And they id said yes, and that's how they got the next level of wealthy. But that company also saw the opportunity to take advantage of people in this new form because there were no rules. You know, these guys didn't have proper representation, so they were kind of chum for the sharks, if you will, that always come circling around when there's a new thing happening. And like that publisher before they got Doom 2 had Richard Simmons' De La Mille CD-ROM and Fabio Screensaver. Nice. Those were their two products. I'm not kidding. I wish I were. But. And so that made me realize that, wow, these guys are certainly no experts in this. We can learn to do this ourselves very easily. And that's what id hired me away from Duango to do. They had figured out that they probably had been taken advantage of a bit as well and hired me to basically investigate and prove that they could publish on their own if they wanted, which we did with Quake. And it really enabled us to renegotiate from a position of power with their publisher to go, look, we don't even need you. We can do this ourselves. We've just proven it. And so they got like three times better a deal on Quake than they had on Doom 2. And that very short path, like I was only at id for a year and a half, really informed my entire trajectory through publishing. It was like, oh, well, I see what's happening here. It's not that hard, certainly compared to what these guys are doing, you know, rocking the world with this brand new thing. It was 3D gaming. They were literally making magic. I figured out that all I had to do was, you know, not do what these other guys were doing, the other publishers, which was try to take all the credit and try to take all the money and just take advantage of these guys. I was like, if you look at music and film, eventually the talent is going to be what's important in this industry. And maybe we could just skip those decades where, you know, you have to fight to figure that out And if one hit is enough to carry all of these existing publishers, then, you know, I'm pretty sure we could, just with our friends, we can have that one hit or two hits or three hits and be really important. And more importantly than that, than our success, to be really loud for an industry of new developers that were not yet talking to each other at all about businessy stuff. Like, there was just no information out there on what a good deal even was. So we changed that with gathering of developers and published, you know, here's actually what you should be going for, whether it's with us or somebody else. This is what a good deal looks like. And that really changed the game forever. You know, the developers realized how, to what extent they had been taken advantage of, even if they had made titles that sold in the millions of units back then. So it was a really, it was like being in early Hollywood. It was so exciting a time for somebody in their mid-20s with not quite a college degree to be reshaping the way these conversations went, because of the opportunity that I started off in a position of power with these guys that were basically the Beatles of this new industry back then.
And they had the kind of hottest product at the time, and it was in the shareware model as well, which was something a bit different. You know, what did you kind of think of that, and how did you go from shareware to retail? I find that really interesting.
Yeah, so the shareware model was developed by Scott Miller at 3D Realms, the guys that made Duke Nukem, and he was id's publisher with the first Wolfenstein and a couple of other smaller games they made before that. And so he had educated them on what was important already, keeping their intellectual property rights, making sure they got credit. And he's like, the way to do this is just own your own customer, you know, and take out the middlemen. And when you have something as good as Doom or Quake or Wolfenstein or Duke Nukem, you can very confidently just give away a piece, you know, for free, and know that people are going to want to pay for it because it's that good. Like, if your product's not good, shareware is suicide. You know, that's when you just need a flashy, back in the day, it was a flash box and some nice ads, and people wouldn't find out they had bought a turd until it was already installed on their computer and they had paid for it.
It was quite interesting as well, because just letting people know, you know, there are extra levels. There is a full game at the end. And I remember that huge screen, you know, at the end of the game, like paused on it. Yeah, you can get the shareware version here.
Yeah, in those early days of that, you know, Adrian starting to make money and those guys starting to make money was really when people were just mailing them checks directly. And they were mailing back floppy disks just in a brown envelope, which is mad to think about. But they sold, you know, over 100,000 of those directly in 1993 of mailed in checks, you know, and nothing had been done like that at all, direct to consumer, never mind in this industry, but in any entertainment industry. And so that also gave them a sense of power and control. And so even though they signed, you know, they didn't have the ability to put things in Walmart and CompUSA and all these stores of the time. So that's why they let GT Interactive handle that, all the shipping of boxes to stores and all that stuff, because it seemed so hard. But they always retained their shareware rights so that they could still have that direct relationship with the customer. And that was really another big paradigm shift, was allowing a fan of a game to build a relationship with the people who actually made it, rather than with some publisher name. Like, the idea that you could have a relationship with Activision, who makes, you know, what was making 100 games a year back then of all different varieties and all different levels of quality. Mm. You know, you can't really build you can't be a fan of that. You know, you have to.
True. Like, id Software Games felt really personal and really like, you know, the guys. And you know, you're just playing one of the guys' games. It was
And it's still a problem today in the industry. You know, most people don't know who made their favorite games. They might know a studio name and logo, but they really don't know the people behind it, because it is usually a team, and those teams are getting so large that it's, you know, ridiculous to try to introduce. But when that indie revolution came back around, it was such a relief for me, because the industry had gotten so big all of a sudden and was suddenly being taken very seriously. and many, many, many millions of dollars and these giant public companies sort of running things. And the fun factor was just going in the opposite direction of the growth factor. So the opportunity to get back to that time where a few people, you know, making pixel art games could make something that rocked the world again, you know, I just felt so fortunate because it was a real callback to the beginning when it was just a few people that could do that. And that it had come to seem impossible, you know, because everything had to be big.
We had a real kind of bedrooms to billions kind of coda scene in it. And it felt very like that. You know, that PC period where you had the home coders and then suddenly it was the biggest game on the planet. You know,
it's absolutely. Yeah. And getting to be the guy to make that phone call to some guys that were, you know, maybe asking you sheepishly for help with rent while they were finishing the game, to be able to call them and just say, hey, you never have to worry about rent again and don't bother paying us back. You know, like your life has changed for good if you're smart about it. And that's just very different than calling a studio and patting them on the back for having a better quarter.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's again, kids don't grow up wanting to be business people. And I certainly never did either. But that part of it is a joy that is, yeah, you have to be on the publishing side to do it. That's still where the power lies, unless you're so strong that you can be a pure indie and just handle literally everything yourself, which is a rare bird indeed that is not only good at everything it takes from marketing and all the rest, but enjoys it, you know? Like people can begrudgingly do it, but if it's your least favorite thing, it's probably not going to be as good as somebody that really loves that part of it, you know, loves to build an audience. So it's not so bad being a business person.
It's good to see, it resonated with me that did the ringing somebody up and saying you don't have to worry about rent. It feels a lot more human, if you will, which does sound nice.
Absolutely.
So with the expectations of Quake, when that was coming out, obviously Doom was huge. Everything was really going, you know, really, really well. I think I liked you saying there they were the Beatles at the time, which sounded fantastic. Was there a lot of pressure for the marketing team to grow? Was there high expectations?
There was no team.
Oh, really? Was it just you?
It was me. Yeah, it was me. And I had a boss, the biz guy and CEO, Jay Wilbur, who's been at Epic ever since, selling Unreal licenses. I had a boss, so that was nice. I did have a mentor, but he hired me to take all the PR and marketing stuff off of him. And luckily, we got to work with brilliant agencies at the time that could make me look like I knew what I was doing. But yes, there was so much pressure around Quake. I remember one PC gamer or somebody was, the headline was like, Christ himself couldn't live up to this advanced billing.
Oh, wow.
You know, if he were to return tomorrow. Yeah. And we did worry about that, you know, and Quake, like any game in development, was not always fun while it was in development. It was like, this is not working, you know, such as the moment where they realized that they had created this medieval world, but suddenly they realized they really missed rocket launchers. and so just in a day, they were like, made up a reason that made sense. And like we all. It was one of the very rare times John Carmack asked me what I thought about a major decision like that. And I was brand new. And I'm like, I don't care. You guys are the Beatles. I'm driving the van. Like if we need rocket launchers, then we need rocket launchers. And people will forgive us for the story, you know, if they even notice that there is one. So, yeah, it was so much pressure and so much hype. But it was also super exciting because I could go into as the new kid, you know, going to all these major sort of stodgy retail buyer meetings. Sometimes I had to even put on like a suit or a jacket, but I had the hottest thing in the world, you know, so it was easy to have a swagger about it. And I was quite sure that by the time I was having those meetings that these guys had found the magic because we were already death matching in the office and Carmack had figured out how to enable people to play over the internet for free, thereby eliminating the need for Duango and those high phone bills. And I remember the day he walked into my office and told me, you should call the Duengo guys. Quake's going to have free internet play. And at the time, no one could conceive of a fast-paced Twitch-style shooter, a competitive deathmatching game, really being able to run over the sad state of the internet in 1996, you know. But Carmack made it go, and that was the beginning of, you know, everything that everybody's doing today on with online action games. And it was the end of my poor, well-meaning friends at Twango.
Well, also Nine Inch Nails getting involved as well. Do you have any memories of that?
Yeah, that was a super cool moment. That happened because Trent Reznor was just a big fan of Dune and loved playing it on the tour bus. And so he actually rang it up, or had his manager do it, and wanted to do the music for the next one. And of course, the id guys were stoked. But it was another really important lesson for me, because Trent Reznor was already a guy, you know, super forward on the style of music and his technical proficiency for musicians at the time. And yeah, he knew his way around a computer, which was great. But also, he had his own record label, but it was owned by a bigger record label. And I learned through that deal that he wasn't actually in control of anything. And he was making like $1 per CD, even though he owned his own record label, and he wasn't in control of what he could do with his own name or voice.
Oh, wow.
You know, and it blew my mind. And I knew that, you know, that had been the way of the record industry, and that's what I was trying to avoid. But I had no idea that at that time, my guys were making so much more per sale, whether it was direct or through a store, than this famous dude with his own record label and, you know, international distribution. And the fact that he didn't own the right to use his own voice without their permission. And so he literally had to do a contract saying he was doing sound effects for the game rather than music. And we couldn't use the name. We did have the 9 ammo boxes in there. They did own their own logo. But it would have been a very different soundtrack had Trent Reznor been able to do whatever he wanted, you know. But to skirt around the chains, because id wasn't going to pay a load of money that the labels wanted, because back at the time, game music just wasn't considered that crucial. You know, it was that's nice. They paid some attention to music. But id wasn't about to invest a ton of money into it at the time, because they were self-funding. And so, yeah, Trent just made it happen any way he could, which was still an incredible soundtrack for the time. And I see people posting online that they still pop it in the car and listen to it every now and then if they still have a CD player. But yeah, it was just for me, it was a really defining moment seeing these artists from the tops of two industries, you know, and one everybody considers mainstream cool. And the other one was this new closet culture, super nerdy thing. And that we were already so far ahead of those guys in terms of how the artists were being treated. And it just made me really proud of where I was, and made me more determined than ever to carve a path for artists to not ever be in that position where they're not in control of their own name or voice. That is the most... And that's, you know, that's why Prince changed his name to the symbol for several years.
Yeah, artist formerly known as. You know,
because Warner Brothers owned the name Prince and for a certain amount of years. And then as soon as that period was over, he changed his name back to Prince. You know, but that's what the whole thing was about. Even though he was already massively successful at a meal ticket for these guys, they still had this boot on your neck type mentality and the way they treated artists. And all of those things gave me my mission, you know, in the games industry to make it not that way.
Well, before Gathering of Developers, we had Ion Storm as well. And that was a bit of a storm in itself.
It was.
I was just wondering what your memories of the infamous John Romero is about to make you his bitch line.
Wow, man, that's the ad that won't die for sure, which, you know, as a marketer, you say that's a good thing. In the games industry at the time, it wasn't necessarily, but it was the perfect, like, that's the tempest in the teapot of what was going on there, and the ego, the bravado at the time, that was pervasive. Like, that was Romero at that age. There was certainly no sensitivity training going on in the office places at the time. And our ad agency came up with that for him because we didn't have anything to show and it was time to start marketing. And I thought it was hilarious and I thought it was very John, and John did too for about an hour. And then he was like, I don't know, Mike. Yeah. And I was like, just do it. At the end of the day, he signed off on it and everybody thought it was great. And then it really wasn't until the game kept getting delayed and then wasn't what any of us hoped it would be, that we didn't have the backup for such big talk, put it that way. And so it was a big lesson in how seriously people were taking this new passion, this new media form, and how they didn't want it to become a joke or a, you know, whatever. They were just, it was the most stressful and educational 12 months of my career, I think, being at that place. Oh. And I left there to go with John because I wanted to make God Games happen. And id, after I renegotiated and got them such a great deal and landed them, moved them to Activision, they were like, well, we don't need to build a publisher. They're like, thanks, Mike. You did a great job. And they didn't want to hire more businessy people. They just wanted to stay a small developer with a really good deal, which I think was the right thing to do. But John saw the vision, and Iron Storm was originally supposed to be part of founding Gathering and Developers. But with the way things were going at Iron Storm, it was obviously not the right time and place to be starting a publisher. So that's why I was only there for a year and then went off to start God Games.
Yeah, well, Gathering of Developers was just absolutely insane. Like, some of the titles that have come out of that group, amazing. Like, how was it founded, and, you know, how important was Take-Two's original check to help you kind of get you there?
It was founded out of that idea that I described before, when I was like, if one hit is enough to carry these very large companies, then it could certainly carry a small company. And if we had two or three hits, then we'd be immediately one of the most important labels there are in this business. And no one was calling it a label at the time but me, because I was so focused on what had happened to the music industry and not letting it happen. And I was like, you can bitch about this from the outside, or you can fix it from the inside. And that's what I was trying to do. And so we just went around to some other friends, and Dallas was sort of the center of the universe at that time for especially PC games. So we had the guys that made Monster Truck Madness and like Microsoft Flight Sim and Age of Empires and the Duke Nukem guys, and all of these people that were spawning off of each other in Dallas. And so I just went around and I told them the story of id's deal and the new deal I had gotten them, and that I knew that that was a financially viable model and fair for everyone. We had proven it, and several of these developers literally cried in those meetings because they had much, much worse deals than id had and didn't own any of their intellectual property or their names, and had made, you know, huge hits, like mainstream hits for the time. And so we just rounded up a group of those. I didn't ask any of them to sell their companies or combine their companies or IP. We just created a new thing and gave those six studios a piece of the new thing. So now they still own their studios, still had their autonomy, but now they also own part of this new publishing thing, and they just had to commit future titles to it. But what they did more importantly for us is I had seen how easy it was at the time to trick business guys with just a couple of screenshots, because most of them played golf, not games, you know, and they had no idea what they were talking about or what they were selling. So like, we literally could cobble together, you know, a couple of made up screenshots and some bullet points and get a deal done, you know, with these guys, because they were easy to fool. And I didn't want to be easy to fool or ever think I was so smart that I should be choosing the games or my marketing people that I hired. So we had those six founding developers actually choosing the titles for us. So we had, you know, experienced, successful game developers evaluating pitches instead of marketing and accounting people chasing trends. And that's why we had just hit after hit in such a short amount of time. And Take-Two, Ryan Brandt, their original CEO, and that $5 million check he gave me at the last possible minute contractually to keep this alliance together was the reason we got to prove it, you know, and we got to exist. He was also the reason that, he sort of took advantage of our naivete as well. Take-Two did much better with gathering up developers than we did, especially after they absorbed it and bought several of the studios. Mm. But it doesn't really matter. We had proven the point, you know, yeah. And we had changed the model. And so other developers were demanding similar deals from their publishers. And the publishers that, you know, the curtain had been pulled back. We had shown what a good deal looked like. So the information was out there and can't really be undone. You can't put that information genie back in the bottle. You can still try to bully developers around, but once they find their power one way or another and realize that they're the important part of the equation, and they have, and they're armed with the proper information and perhaps a good attorney, you know, we're slowly chipping away at that imbalance of power. And it's really just about deferring that power to the guys making the magic, you know, the experts on this media, instead of the guys that were just at Nabisco and now they're selling games, you know, and no shade on those guys. That's just the way it happened, you know, because the industry didn't exist. So they were bringing executives from other completely unrelated packaged goods industry and putting them in charge. Mm-hmm. And once these guys are executives and they're funding the games, it's a rare individual that can still defer the power, right? Because you're like, well, I'm paying for it and I know what'll sell. These guys, what do they know? They never leave their room, you know? And it's that attitude that this is the reason so many terrible films get greenlit and so many terrible games get greenlit. It's the wrong people wielding too much power that actually shouldn't be. And that was honestly, like, it's a one trick that we had a few tricks, but that was probably the most important one for all of the publishing companies my partners and I established, was just saying, hey, we are not the important ones. You are. And we have opinions, but every single decision is yours. And when you do that, guess what? People trust you and your opinions and your input a lot more.
Well, speaking of the important ones there, was it important to keep them happy? Huge events, barbecues, maybe. Do you think that was what can you tell you about that?
Yeah, it was important to, for me, it really bummed me out that the industry was finding a way to not have fun, even though we were literally in the business of fun. They were finding a way to make it boring and stodgy, you know, and to not treat people like people, you know, and I'm just like, if we're all flying across the country or for people flying in from all over the world, let's show them a good time, you know, and just chill out a bit and remember that we're making video games, not like surgical instruments or something, you know? And so, and that, honestly, like, I just like to throw a party too. So part of it was personal, but it's just the idea of forming a relationship rather than a contractual obligation.
And some of these games that were brought to light are just insanely good. Like, I was a big PC gamer at the time, and some of the stuff that started coming out with games I absolutely loved. I've just got a few of them. I was wondering which one are your favorites, but Jazz Jackrabbit 2, Fly, Railroad Tycoon, Max Payne as well, Tropico. I absolutely love Tropico.
Yeah, Tropico's still going.
Yeah, I thought that was something totally different. And of course, Serious Sam as well, Second Encounter, and Railway Tycoon. Do you remember seeing any of these games for the first time and just...
Yeah, Railroad Tycoon was one that blew my mind coming out of action gaming, and that was our first real hit. Jazz Jackrabbit, by the way, is still one of the best side-scrollers ever made. Jazz Jackrabbit
2. So underrated too, like, as well,
exquisitely done by these guys named Orange in Amsterdam, but produced by Epic. Anyway, it was fantastic, and that was our first title. But then we had our first bona fide hit with Railroad Tycoon 2. And for me, simulation games was a whole new thing. And I could not believe that there were so many fans, not just of that genre, but about trains, that there were even in the States, which is very sort of trains averse compared to the rest of the world. There were 12 magazines at the time for train enthusiasts. And it was just, I remember how mind-blowing it was to me that, you know, there's these weird cultures around all of these different interests, and games is just a new thing that they can do with something they already loved. And I also realized that I learned more from playing that game that I did in college about business. You know, so it was a early hint into the power of games that aren't branded as educational for actually being incredibly educational, because you focus on it and you want to learn it to win. Yeah. You know,
I was wondering as well, like, how important was Doug Myers to Gathering and to yourself as well?
Doug was our heart and soul. I met him at Ion Storm, and for lack of a better way to put it, he was literally the best man I had met, and it, like, just Christ-like in his kindness and presence and forgiveness and grace. And he sort of redefined what being cool was to all of us, you know, and coming out of Ion Storm, that was very important for me and my personal growth, to have an example that just exuded all of the things that I think later God Games and Devolver would become known for with the people that worked with us, you know, that whether they worked with us on one game that did okay, or they made multiple hits with us. I think if you talk to all of those developers, that kindness and openness and presence and humanity would be the main storyline you would get from all of them. And again, it was really important to realize how much that impacted, like, the whole industry was sort of cheering for us.
Yeah.
Even some of our direct competitors were secretly wishing they worked with us and cheering us on. And that felt great in what had become a pretty cutthroat competitive industry, to go, wow, if you just overwhelm people with kindness and generosity, they, you know, you get a real tailwind behind you, because the gamers sense it or feel it in the games, because they're coming from happy developers, and the industry sensed it. And we're like, can't we all just be cool? You know, why can't we just hug each other and meet it, and now, you know, make each other barbecue?
It's important to have people like that, definitely.
Absolutely. We only learn by example, really, you know.
I was wondering about Substance TV as well, because when I saw that, I thought, this idea is definitely ahead of, you know, what was kind of going on at the time. What was the idea with it? And also, how did the kind of mission and philosophy of Substance connect with Devolver and later on?
Yeah. It was really, that was more about Doug. It was the project Doug and I were talking about doing after the company had been bought by Take-Two. We had to wait a year to leave, and we were pretty sure we were going to leave. And so we were talking about what's next, and Doug was a film school guy, and really he was doing all of our video and trailers back when that was just becoming important on the internet. He saw it coming, and there at the time I was not allowed to work in the games industry for a couple of years. That was part of my separation agreement with Take-Two, was I was being paid to not work in the games industry, which is a really good gig.
And just as context, it was a DVD service, magazine based on kind of Gen X, and you had, you know, loads of different aspects of it as well. You had music, you had film, you had truth, you had all these different elements to it.
It was this weird dark time when MTV had gone away as far as being important for music. There was really, the video hadn't really become efficient or enjoyable on the internet yet. So there was no place to watch music videos. There was no place to watch award-winning short films or short documentaries. All the stuff that we take for granted that's just unlimited today, there was really no place to access that. And for me, it was an opportunity to get out of this culture that I had found myself in and get out and find out what was just a daisy chain of cool people doing cool things that you never thought of, you know, that were living these lives that, because if you put a camera in front of somebody for a couple of hours, they'll tell you their best friends don't know eventually. You know, you just let it roll. And so for me, it was really kind of a way to hide behind that camera and learn about different possibilities of the future. And yeah, it was a DVD that would come in the mail to you every, I think it, we were doing 10 issues a year. So it was every 5 weeks or something. It would come to you in the mail. Mm-hmm. And it would be, you know, 2.5 hours worth of all of the things I just mentioned, really esoteric in nature. But I think kind of like people are like, what makes a Devolver game? And even though they're so wildly different, all genres and all sizes, there was a through line to it that was like, this is cool and real. And these artists are real and important, and you should know them and know their work. But it was when DVD players were still nearly $300 and almost no one knew that the technology has interactive capabilities. Like, so we had quite a sophisticated technical product at a time where no one wanted that or knew about it. And we didn't have a lot of time because I was carrying most of the God Games crew with me in this new venture in an industry that didn't exist. And so we had to swing for the fence, and we very nearly got it into all the Starbucks in the country, which would have probably allowed it to sustain itself. But our demo CD locked up their laptop in the meeting.
Oh,
so.
No.
So it was my favorite project that I couldn't do for much longer.
You were just too ahead of the time.
we were. And there, you know, now all of that stuff exists. And it sort of reminds me of what Heavy.com or Vice later became. It's just this place where you're going to go and get this particular flavor of honesty, at least in the beginning of Vice.
That's crazy. So you did Gamecock Media Group next. And when that came around, you could publish for all platforms, not just PC. Did this massively increase the range of games you could find and publish? What was that like?
It was actually much harder because the industry had gotten big and nobody wanted to talk about PC was dead. Nobody wanted to talk about PC only anymore. And so we got swept up into that because when we were raising money for the company, we're like, okay, well, the $5 million check from God Games is not going to do it anymore. We need like $50 million to start a library. And everything had to be multi-platform, which made everything way more expensive. And suddenly, when you went to publish one of these games on console and retail, you had to make this huge bet on the inventory because every disc you press, you had to pay Microsoft or Sony or Nintendo $10 for, regardless of whether it sold or it got returned. So you would have to make this huge bet right at the end. And if things didn't sell, you know, you lost really big. And the economy really, when it crashed in 2008, our investors pulled out because it was so much money and so much risk that we didn't really get to see much of Gamecock come to fruition. But the reason we got back together is in between Substance and Gamecock, I got hired back at Take-Two to run their PC business, which had become massive while Rockstar had become massive on console. And I learned just how well we had really done with God Games from the inside, because now I was at Take-Two and seeing the royalty reports. And I was like, guys, everything we did sold. Everything made money, and they're sending out royalty checks and much more than they led us to believe. And so that moment really inspired us to get the band back together and take a swing with Gamecock. And when the economy crashed and the investors pulled out very quickly, we were in a bit of a panic like everyone else, you know, and suddenly we had no company and all the games that were coming out were not going to come out. And it was really hard, but from the ashes of that, Devolver was born. And it was born in the most beautiful way because we had been talking to our old friends, Crow Team, that made Serious Sam for God Games back in the day. We'd been talking to them for Gamecock. And then when there was no Gamecock, they were like, well, we still want to work with you guys. And so we just started with that one Serious Sam HD remake. And that's all we had for like the first year. And it was cool because it made us go slow. And with the splashiness of Gamecock and the sort of like, I don't know, it wasn't great. That was if a midlife crisis were a company, it would have been Gamecock.
It's a really interesting kind of time because, as you said, like the market was crashing. There was also, I saw PC game indie releases, and they weren't regarded as high up or as good quality as, you know, the, some of the titles that came out. Now it's a completely different time. We've seen, you know, indie game releases come out that are in high regard. And Crow Team as well, you know, based in Croatia, they weren't seen as one of the top quality studios. Now they're totally on top, you know, it's fantastic. And it's got that great FPS connection, like that original connection with Serious Sam as well. So what was it like when that suddenly became a huge hit and people suddenly started to get on board with it?
It was wonderful because these were our old friends from back in the day that they could only work with us because of the way God Games worked. They still own the IP, you know, and they had made most of the money and they got tangled up with Take-Two for a while and saw how that was and made it, them appreciate us more. And so the fact that we could go back to these guys that, by the way, they had been friends and working together since they were 6 and 8, riding bicycles around the neighborhood together. The core of Crow Team was that bonded. And to see them have success with that same IP that they own because of us in the first place, it was just poetic justice for all of the in-between. And then when they came out later with the Talos Principle, which was just out of left field, like could not be more different than Serious Sam. And it was just gorgeous and smart and so well written. And it really made people go, oh, these guys are not like a one note situation. This is some real serious artistry happening here. And then they, you know, they became part of Devolver when Devolver went public a few years ago. They're now internal. So I think that's really cool because they were our original partner from three companies ago. So,
and do you find now, you know, you had some amazing releases, some of my favorite, Broforce and Hotline Miami as well. And do you see like bigger companies now trying to emulate this kind of indie game feel and like scrambling for titles as well? Is it harder to find newer stuff?
Somewhat. The big companies, our level of success, even with Hotline Miami, is not big enough to make a difference at a company as big as Activision or Ubisoft or something. So it was this beautiful opportunity where we're not competing with those guys. And they were plenty big enough for us to be to make a lot of money and for the developers to get rich, properly rich. You know, and we were now giving people 70% of the profits, which felt great. And yeah, just that new wave of tiny teams, again, took us back to the old days. And by the way, just to jump back, Gamecocks, the best game to come out of there that actually shipped while we were still there was a two-person team that made a horror game for the Nintendo DS called Dementium the Ward that was a proper, scary, atmospheric shooter on a platform that was considered very much, you know, kids' fair and, you know, Mario such. And so that was really my first experience with that. Oh, wow. Two, even in that console era, two guys delivered this small, just laser-focused title for a very niche audience and did great. You know, everybody made money. And it, so it was a great lesson to get in that time where everything had become so bloated and expensive and dangerous to build, you know, the risk. So, yeah, when the Denaton guys came around and Vlambeer and, you know, all these other tiny teams, 1 to 3 people getting rich, you know, and getting those phone calls to not worry about rent really gave us, for me, I was becoming pretty jaded about the industry in general, you know, having to sell Gathering before we wanted to, Gamecock having the rug totally pulled out from under us because of the economy and some billionaires that thought they were going to have less billions or something. We just never wanted that to happen again. It takes so much energy to build a brand and to wait it out when games are late and to navigate these relationships. And the we became really aware of the mental health problem with these small teams that are supposed to do everything for the game, but also now be completely available on the internet to their audience.
The crunch and all of that,
The crunch and just the nastiness of Twitter and, you know, like these guys. And, you know, as a creative throughout the process, you're going to feel like it sucks most of the time and that you suck. And to be able to jump on the internet and have 1 million people agree with you at any given time when you're at your lowest was a real new challenge that no artist in the history of making art has had to deal with. And seeing the Denaton guys in particular really struggle, and luckily having the bravery to talk to us about it, to feel safe to talk to us about it, really, again, just reinforced that idea that these are not a studio or a brand. These are human beings, you know, that we have relationships with and that we were lucky enough to work with. And because of that, because of that honesty and that trust and those relationships, you know, they just, one introduced us to the next, and they're all like, they just do what they say and they give us most of the money and they pay us as soon as they get it. They're fantastic. And that, again, as a business person, the reason no kid wants to do that when they grow up is because most people don't have a very positive opinion of business people for good reason. And so to be able to turn that on its head feels amazing to me, you know, and to empower artists to trust and the incredible work that comes when you remove all of the nastiness of business.
Wow. That is a absolutely fantastic place to end. And I think that was beautifully put with the mental health comments and having the strength to talk to you guys. I think that was really, really good, Mike. Our last question we always have for our guests is, what do you have planned next, if you're allowed to talk about what's next?
I have something that's already public that I can talk about that is a mental health related nonprofit my wife and I started after Devolver went public. It's called Medicinal Media. Cool. And it's basically a publication and production company, sort of like what Substance was doing or what Vice was doing, but it's really focused on all of the incredible accessible digital tools that people lean on for when they need help with their mental health. And a lot of people clearly have leaned on gaming all along, sort of self-medicated with their favorite game and moments of anxiety or stress. But now there's real science around that. So it's fun. These are all like art forward, science back stories about what has worked for people around the world that doesn't require access to healthcare or therapy necessarily. And then linking on the back end to the studies that sort of back it up. So I'm really excited about the potential for digital media's ability to help people connect and heal and, you know, form community and all the things that you're trying to do in therapy anyway. Get these feelings of mastery that you get from games, but it's not just games. There's like cinema therapy and, you know, poetry podcasts that got people through the pandemic and all of this stuff, but it's all presented really beautifully. And I'm very proud in 2024 that we are paying a human being to write all these stories and we're commissioning real art made by another human being to go with each piece. And we've got a team that's incredibly happy to be doing this work. So please, everyone, check out Medicinal Media. It's a good thing to have in your feed on social media or just in the newsletter or whatever. Just a reminder that not all media is there to make you feel bad.
We'll definitely put it in our show notes, Mike, because that's really important for all of our listeners. But thank you so much for joining us. We've fit so much into an hour. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks. Miracle what a little coffee will do for an old man. But thank you guys so much for the invite and for the really good questions. And yeah, I look forward to hearing the finished product and checking out the rest of your stuff.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.